Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Only words now for Teddy K.
What I wrote, I said, you know, today an angel has earned his wings and
your dream will live forever.
Teddy, thank you for letting us be part of this making history.
I feel like I have to be there and say my goodbyes tonight.
And I just see all these people, I'm like, wow.
There'll be no other time I can show you how my love.
He's the good guy.
He's a real deal.
You have to bless him. He will always be in our hearts.
It's just the end of an era for me.
And I will give you all my life. I'm here if you should call to me.
They're lining up in Boston to say goodbye to Teddy Kennedy and the era he takes with him. For lefties and righties, it's a whole different game without the Kennedys. So for now,
it's only words. Words are all I have to take your heart away.
Fortunately, words are just fine for radio and on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Friday, August 28th. I'm John Hockenberry here with Femi Okeh. Good morning, Femi.
Hello there, John. Goodness, you can hear the love in the voices of the mourners
indeed
out there in Boston.
More coming up.
So coming up this morning, we also have the growing casualty count in Afghanistan and the human worries it produces for families back at home. And Frank Bruni, he's the outgoing restaurant critic and our partner, The New York Times. He talks about his struggle with food.
First, Lily Hackard, what words did you write in that memorial book for Ted Kennedy last night in Boston?
Well, it was so many family members walking through the group and shaking hands. I told them, thank you to the family for sharing this time with us.
Oh, that's sweet. Lily, how old are you?
Well, I'm 65.
All right. A full-blown citizen of the United States who's voted many times. Thanks for being with us, Lily.
Thank you.
Chris Lydon, longtime journalist and political observer in Massachusetts. Will people like Lily get a chance to make a statewide vote for a Kennedy ever again, do you think?
I think so, John. I would be shocked and surprised if Joe Kennedy, Robert Kennedy's son, didn't re-enter politics. This longing for a Kennedy is real. I can't imagine it'll go away.
Christopher Lydon, we'll be back with you in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, hundreds of firefighters are working to put out wildfires around the Los Angeles County. Flames are threatening a number of communities there, forcing evacuations. And moving to the East Coast, a tropical storm watch is on for the coastal part of North Carolina. Tropical storm Danny is weaker this morning, but still expected to produce dangerous waves along the coast.
Back to California, a woman kidnapped and held 18 years is now free of her captors. Stacey Lee Dugard was 11 when she was taken from the South Lake Tahoe, California community. Authorities say she was kept in isolation from 100 miles away near Antioch, California. They say she was abused and forced to have two children. The kidnappers, suspected kidnappers, are in custody. Wall Street was up just a touch yesterday. The Dow opens today at 95.81. The S&P starts trading at 10.31. And the NASDAQ begins at 20.28. We're talking about President Obama's poor foreshortened vacation. In this era, we're all like the president. It's impossible to turn off. How do you turn off and have a real vacation? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I grew up with the Kennedys. I can't remember when there wasn't a Kennedy in politics or in the Senate or in the White House. And it's just the end of an era for me. It really is. So that's why I'm here. Didn't even think about it. Just came.
And 54-year-old Caitlin Roberts came from Peabody, Massachusetts, to pay her respects to Senator Ted Kennedy, whose body is lying in state at the JFK Museum in Boston. Darren Ring from Weymouth, Massachusetts. Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
You were first in line this morning to pass through the museum. What was it like?
It was surreal. I was surprised at how many people weren't here yet, being first in line. I just wanted to make sure that I got an opportunity to get inside, of which I have. The guard standing at attention was awesome. You know, it was such a... I'm speechless over it. It was so surreal.
Now, surreal is one emotion, but personally, why did you bring your heart and your sort of recollections of Ted Kennedy in person to this museum?
Well, you know, growing up around here, you saw Senator Ted on television almost daily. Myself being a little bit of a history buff, I was fascinated with the entire Kennedy legacy. You know, not being fortunate enough to see John or Robert in office, but you know, seeing all of the footage and reading books over the years about them, it was just, you know, it's important for me to be able to be here. You know, not, you know, as well to, you know, mourn, help, you know, show my condolences for a family in mourning, but also there's probably people all around the country that don't have the opportunity to come here who would love to be here. And being so close to home, I said, you know, it's real important for, you know, as many people as possible to be here and show their appreciation to the Kennedy family for what they've done for
the state
of Massachusetts.
Darren Ring standing outside the JFK Museum there in the glide path at Logan Airport, live in Boston from Weymouth, Massachusetts. 41-year-old, one of the people first in line this morning to go through to see Ted Kennedy's body lying in repose. Darren, give the phone back to my colleague Sean Corcoran there.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Darren.
Hi, John. Sean.
So, Sean, you described that the line was slinking out of sight there. You're a senior reporter with WCAI, Cape Cod's public radio station. You've been talking to us about this since Wednesday. What's going on right now?
It's the same. More people, they just keep coming and coming. They're moving folks through the library fairly quickly. But the line, I really couldn't even tell you where it ends right now. I couldn't even estimate how many people. There must be thousands of people, all sorts. I just saw a Native American in full regalia enter the museum, people in wheelchairs, all colors, all ages.
Can you hand the phone to Ann Zeller there from New Hampshire, who drove up with her husband today?
Absolutely. Here's Ann.
Hello.
Hey there, Ann. You weren't first in line, but you're pretty early. What's your reason for being there this morning?
Well, I, as a teenager, I worked for Jack Kennedy, and then I worked on Bobby Kennedy's campaign, and though I never had the pleasure of campaigning for Teddy, I've always supported him and followed his career. I think this family, that in many ways to me, they embody the American dream. They came from immigrant stock and worked hard and became privileged and could have just stayed privileged. And instead, they spent their lives, gave their lives in some cases.
Well, and you're a part of that story from Fremont, New Hampshire, part of the line of mourners gathering to pay their respects to Ted Kennedy at JFK Museum in Boston. Thanks, Ann.
Ted Kennedy is leaving a vacant Senate seat that he first filled back in 1962, and before that, his brother, John Kennedy, also was in office in that Senate seat. That was back in 1952. Now, several other Kennedys have been mentioned as possible successors, both Ted's wife, Vicky, and his nephew, Joe. So joining us to talk about what a Senate race might be like for either of them, should they decide to run, is Chris Lydon, longtime journalist and political observer in Massachusetts. Welcome back, Chris.
Nice to be here.
So, Chris, what is the public sentiment in Massachusetts right now surrounding Vicky and Joe?
There's always been an air of grace about the Kennedy name and an air of forgiveness. I'm thinking of that first campaign of 1962 when Ted Kennedy was ridiculed by his Democratic opponent, Eddie McCormick, who said, you know, if your name were Edward Moore, your candidacy would be a joke. A few days later, Ted Kennedy in a factory... A mill worker said that they say you haven't worked a day in your life. And he said, you haven't missed a damn thing. And don't forget it. At Chappaquiddick, most particularly when Ted Kennedy fell as low and by his own doing as he ever did, it was the people who brought him up and brought him back. he didn't run a good campaign against Mitt Romney, but he came back. It is a beloved institution. It's a defining institution in Massachusetts, and I cannot believe that it's over.
But it is over, so we're looking at what happens next. How about another Kennedy stepping up? How much pressure do you feel that Boston, Massachusetts, is actually putting on the Kennedys to find somebody to step into that Senate seat?
Well, they don't have to look that far, Fanny. I mean, Joe Kennedy, Robert Kennedy's son, was a congressman before. He had his ups and downs, but he was an excellent, excellent public servant, ran hard, served well, could have been reelected forever, might very well have been elected governor of Massachusetts if he'd chosen to be.
Chris, on that point, let me just go back to 1997. It's a little time ago, but this is what Joe said about not running for governor.
I think it would have continued to focus on my family. I think it would have been continued to focus on very personal issues. And I don't believe that would have been good for my family, and I don't think it would have been good for the people of this state.
Chris, has he got the stamina to go for it this time round?
I who knows for me? I think I'd be guessing, but I think he does. I think he's a serious public servant. He's stayed in the realm of, you know, inexpensive oil for poor people. It's bred into the bone, I presume to say, and I can't believe that he or others will let it go.
Well, Christopher Lydon, you know, you've covered this a long, long time in Massachusetts. Let's talk about the bones of the Massachusetts voters. As Emily Rooney said on this program yesterday, there's always been a third of Massachusetts citizens who have been opposed to a Kennedy under any circumstances. Maybe this is a good moment for a pause. And there may be no statewide Kennedy in Massachusetts or in New England for 4 years, maybe even six.
It's perfectly possible. I was surprised that Joe Kennedy gave it up when he did in the House seat, which had also been in the family since 1946, or Tip O'Neill's family. Anything is possible, of course. It is. We're a regular, open, competitive state like anybody else. There are plenty of others who would take a run at it that they thought they had a shot, including Deval Patrick, the governor. I've always thought Barney Frank would love to be a United States senator.
That's interesting.
And there are plenty more.
That might be the choice, you know. Now that you mention it, that might be the one.
Barney.
Barney, yeah.
I think, you know, Barney was close. Barney has been steady on many, many issues. He has power in his own right in Washington now. I don't think anybody would feel there was a step down in intellect or energy or connection or purpose. On the other hand, the Kennedys are very, very protective of the magic of their own name and their own place. I remember when Ted Kennedy, for whatever reasons, blocked Kevin White from the Democratic ticket as a vice presidential candidate when George McGovern really wanted him in 1972. This was before Tom Eagleton and Sergeant Shriver. The Kennedys look after the brand, shall we say, the franchise. It's an important asset at this point to them as well as to the state. So I can't imagine, John, it would go by default.
Chris, finally, just to wrap up with this conversation, how are you paying your respects to Senator Ted Kennedy? How are you remembering him?
Well, see my website. Chris, I mean, at radioopensource.org.
Right.
I wrote
go,
my
baby.
Own piece.
I fell into that one.
Yeah, well, I, like everybody else, I am having to come to terms with the fact that this was a most extraordinary character. And I didn't, you know, I covered him many times and we've had our good times. He was always extraordinarily gracious. In the end, to me, he's the proof of Hemingway's line that a man can be destroyed without being defeated, just as he can be defeated without being destroyed.
Christopher Lydon, thank you so very much.
I was really dreaming there. You know, Barney Frank actually took his name out of the running for that Senate seat this week.
Chris Lydon is a journalist and political observer in Massachusetts. Check out his website. He'd love you to. RadioOpenSource.org. That's RadioOpenSource.org. Thanks, Chris.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. As we love to do, we invite Lakshman Achuthan, Managing Director of the Economic Cycle Research Institute, here into the studio this morning. Of course, the Economic Cycle Research Institute is an analysis company that forecasts recessions and recoveries. We've talked with you about the recession ending, about the difference between leading and lagging economic indicators. I'm passing out some handouts on the takeaway.
What is this?
I do my homework for you, Lakshman, okay?
Thank you.
Just hold on to that for a second and we'll talk about it. But this week, the number I want to begin with is the deficit number, right? The Obama administration indicated about a $250 billion error in the yearly deficit number, revising it downward. And then a couple of days later, they indicated a $2 trillion error in the decade deficit number, revising it up from 7 to 9 trillion. We talked with some folks up at Harvard about what this means, but buried in the deficit number are forecasts about the economy, which is an indication of why it goes up and down. What do you see when you look at a story like the deficit number?
Well, the first thing to know is that they're totally unreliable numbers. And I don't think people get that. It really depends on where and when you're projecting from. Back in the year 2000, they were projecting 10 years ahead from the top of a big economic boom, and they saw a $5 trillion surplus, which was, by the way, a key reason that you had the Bush tax cuts. Greenspan came in and said, look at all that money on these projections. It's okay to do a huge tax cut. Today, projecting from the bottom of the bust, the bean counters see a $9 trillion deficit when they look out over the decade. And it's totally alarming if you don't know that these are totally misleading projections.
Now, the deficit rising, is that any indication of a surge in economic activity or just bad planning on the part of the Fed?
Well, let's say they did a revision where they said, oops, it's $2 trillion more in our estimate, right? What that's about is that you're in the nastiest recession you've seen in our lifetime since World War II. And necessarily, when the economy tanks, government spending goes up and revenues for the government go down and the deficit goes up. It's pretty straightforward math. The problem is when you try to extrapolate that out into the future. The key thing is large deficits do need to be brought under control. It all boils down to what kind of recovery do you have? Is it strong and how long does it last?
All right. Here's the Lakshman question. Is fuzziness about the deficit a lagging indicator or a leading indicator? In other words, does it indicate that uncertainty is projecting some uncertainty in the future, or is it something about the past?
Well, I think it's something about what's going on right now. It's more coincident, and it's about where you are when they're doing the projecting. And right now we're at an extreme. We're at the bottom of the business cycle. When the recession ends, you're at the bottom of the business cycle. If you extrapolate that nastiness into the future, it looks really, really bad.
Right. So the trend line is turning, which means forecasting is really, really difficult.
More than usual.
Right. So I did my homework. Last time you were on the program, before we go, you said tallow. Looking at the price of tallow, which is rendered animal fat, which is used in soap and candles and things like that, that's a really interesting leading economic indicator of industrial activity. And I printed out a chart which actually shows that tallow tracks almost directly with the price of oil.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Well, basically, this is a secret, one of our secrets, okay? Tallow is a non-tradable industrial commodity price. That's technically what it is. Oil is totally tradable. Everybody knows about it. So if you're going to speculate about what's going on, you tend to buy and trade oil. It's very difficult to buy and trade animal fat. But the animal fat is revealing the price. When it moves with oil, it tells you that the price moves are real. They're not something dreamed up by traders on Wall Street. They're actually related to economic
activity.
And the fact is, they're bouncing off their lows. They're coming off of where they were in late 08, as is oil, and that's consistent with an industrial revival.
And you can even go to the U.S. Department of Agriculture website and see the daily price of tallow. Lakshman Achuthan, Managing Director of the Economic Cycle Research Institute, digging into the numbers for us. We love it.
So has President Obama actually managed to take any time off during his week-long vacation? It hasn't looked like it. Here's the first time he had to re-emerge from his vacation to talk about Ben Bernanke.
Ben approached a financial system on the verge of collapse with calm and wisdom, with bold action and out-of-the-box thinking that has helped put the brakes on our economic freefall.
And then there was, of course, the sad news about Ted Kennedy.
Over the past several years, I've had the honor to call Teddy a colleague, a counselor, and a friend. And even though we have known this day was coming for some time now, we awaited it with no small amount of dread.
So now for an update on the Obama's working vacation.
What vacation?
Yeah, exactly. It's the Boston Herald writer Laura Rupasu. She is at Martha's Vineyard right now. Busy week, Laura. What's the president up to next?
Well, he's going to a funeral. He's going to Ted Kennedy's funeral tomorrow.
So that means he's leaving the vineyard.
He's leaving the
vineyard. Heading to Boston.
He's going to, tonight he is leaving Martha's Vineyard with the First Lady Michelle Obama. They're flying to Boston. They're staying overnight in a hotel. They're flying in late, so they're not going to the wake at the Kennedy Library. And then tomorrow he will deliver the eulogy at the funeral at 10:30. And then, weather permitting, there's Hurricane Danny that appears to be going to create some havoc this weekend. He will come back here to Martha's Vineyard, pick up the girls, and they will leave on Sunday.
So you're done now then, Laura, end of your assignment?
No, actually I have to go back to Boston and cover the funeral. So I have to stand outside, probably in the rain, tomorrow at the funeral and identify all the notables and VIPs that will be going to Ted's funeral.
Thank you very much, Laura Rupasu. She's a columnist.
Raposa.
Sorry. Laura's going to hate me. I'm so glad she's in Massachusetts right now and I'm in New York. She's the columnist for the Boston Herald. She was getting us up to date on the latest with the president's vacation or working vacation.
Well, we've all turned into the president. We all work on our vacations. None of us can turn off. We all have Blackberries. We're all on email. I mean, President Obama is supposed to be resting on Martha's Vineyard this week, but he keeps taking time for official duties. Laura inspired our question today. How about you? Can you completely stay away from work when you're on vacation? And if so, how do you do it? Our contributor Baratunde Thurston called us to say...
This is Baratunde Thurston calling from Carthage, Missouri, on the road, certainly not on vacation. The most effective way is to go somewhere where there is no signal. A mountainous region far away overseas in the middle of the ocean, Antarctica.
Well, here's another one.
Hey, Troy from Dakota. What bothers me more than cell phone and email watchers on vacation are those poor, obsessed people who are obviously physically fit, but they go on a cruise and they still work out every day. Good grief, you won't lose your abs in a fortnight. I said fortnight for Femi.
Thanks, Troy. Fortnight, translation means 2 weeks together. We're taking a look at some of the big headlines making the news this morning. One of the most interesting stories, a woman kidnapped 18 years ago in South Lake Tahoe, California, now free of her captors. And authorities say she was kept in isolation in California. She was abused and forced to have two children. And also coming up, it's been a deadly month for forces in Afghanistan. We talked to some of their families. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Femi Okay. So at the end of July, we had the really big story out of Afghanistan that it was the deadliest month.
Since the war began there.
That's
yeah,
right.
Absolutely. And then also we're getting figures for August, which is saying that August figures will actually parallel July for
They've tied, and August isn't even over. We reported that yesterday. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mike Mullen, has already said that the situation in Afghanistan is deteriorating. And he said that publicly last Sunday. Mm. So Mary Galletti, Kim Clark, and Larry Severson joining us from Cleveland, Erie, Pennsylvania, and Richmond, Virginia, respectively. They all have family members involved in the war in Afghanistan. Mary Galletti, what goes through your mind when you hear headlines like it's the most brutal month in Afghanistan?
You know, I think it just raises the issue of what support is happening for the families at home. I mean, I know I try and not watch CNN and Fox and all those as much as possible because it just makes me panic. Hmm. So I sort of wonder, you know, what communication is happening between the military and their families to sort of support them through that process.
Kim Clark, what goes through your mind?
You know, I sit and I wait for the next phone call, and I hope that it's not my son's unit that's been affected. It's a very daunting day-to-day, minute-to-minute thing that we live through every day.
Larry Severson, for you?
I'm really disturbed about all this because all I can see is that each month the death tolls are going to go up because, unfortunately, Obama is channeling George Bush, and he has done the mini surge in Afghanistan the way Bush had a surge in Iraq, and because of that surge in Afghanistan, we're only going to see these death tolls rise every month.
Well, three very interesting, different perspectives, and much closer to the front lines than certainly even a news correspondent like myself is. Mary Galletti, you have a husband in Hungary who is going to be deployed in Afghanistan in January, right?
Correct.
And you're from Cleveland, Ohio. Kim Clark, your son has been stationed in Afghanistan how long?
He left the United States on July 23rd.
And Larry Severson, your son Brandon is stationed in Afghanistan, right?
Yes, he left for Afghanistan on July 20th.
For all three of you, and you know, you may have the best perspective on this, what is different about the conflict in Afghanistan from the situation in Iraq? And use as much detail as you can. If you have any stories, I'd love to hear them. Larry?
In all honesty, I don't really see much difference as far as what my son is going through. I have had a couple of emails from him, and he talks about the heat, that it's 127 degrees, and in the tent it's 110 degrees, and he just talks about how hot it is. And as far as myself, I wear a yellow ribbon everywhere I go to remind people that there's a war going on and that we have loved ones there. When I buy a package to mail to him, I tell the clerk checking it out that I'm sending this to a loved one in Iraq, I mean in Afghanistan. When I mail it, I tell the postal worker. You know, the three of us on the phone, we're living through this every day, and the vast majority of Americans have no connection with this war, and we need
exactly
to bring the attention back right to the American people.
Kim Clark, how do you go through your day with reminders of what's going on in Afghanistan? Take me through your day.
The day is different. My son was in Iraq. Matter of fact, last year at this time, he was getting ready to come back to his home base, when he was in Iraq, I had a lot of contact with him. It was very civilized, you know, email, webcams, almost every other day, phone calls. With him being in Afghanistan, I know he's more in the front lines this time around, and he's in Helmand Province somewhere.
Wow.
And you know, so I know he's in the heat of it, and you know, you go through your day. I don't think there's a 15-minute time frame that I don't look at the clock and go, okay, it's 9 hours ahead. What is he doing? Is it hot today? Is he, you know, sleeping in tents? Did he get the shower? Is he eating in a chow hall, or is he eating at MREs? It's an overwhelming experience, and every day I look at the clock and go, okay, it's 6 o'clock at night. I know Marines don't notify after 6 o'clock at night. I say
when you say notify, you mean send bad news.
Send bad news, I thank God that I made it through another day. But then I also say another prayer for the families who haven't, because as we know, the casualties are happening daily over there.
That's right.
And fortunately, he's the last couple of times when there's been mass casualties, he's had the opportunity to call home and say, hey, Mom, it wasn't me. And then, you know, once again, I feel guilty. I think, oh, thank God it wasn't you. But, you know, there's five or six families out there who are just, you know, receiving the news of their life that you don't want to hear.
Mary Galletti, we've been in this war now in Afghanistan for 8 years. In the beginning, there seemed to be a lot of post 9/11 solidarity and awareness of what was going on. What's it like 8 years out for you as a family member?
I mean, quite honestly, I think it's the forgotten war.
Right.
You know, it's interesting because my husband's in the National Guard, and what makes that sort of neat or weird is that there's not a huge military presence around me, right? I don't live on a base. We don't live near a base. And while the National Guard's family support services are outstanding, and I'm not belittling that, with Iraq, there was this universal experience, at least, that everyone who was serving in some capacity had done Iraq.
Right.
And with Afghanistan, it's just less talked about. Hmm. There's less connection. And I think because it's less understood as a country, as a people, as a war, there's been less media coverage, et cetera, that
there's just less to connect to. Right. So it feels like a much more awkward experience.
Well, we've been trying to stay on it. I mean, it is Obama's war, but you're right. The connection is very, very difficult to maintain. Mary Galletti, her husband is training in Hungary to be deployed to Afghanistan in January. Larry Severson, give us a final thought here.
The best way that I can tell military families that might be listening to this show is I'm on the board of Military Families Speak Out. It's an organization of families that have loved ones in the military and have or are serving in Iraq or Afghanistan, and I encourage them to visit our website, join our organization. It's the best support you can get. As the ladies on the call can tell you, the only person that can understand what you're going through is another person that has a loved one on the ground in Iraq or Afghanistan. It's a horrible, horrible situation to go through.
And Larry Severson, whose 38-year-old son is stationed in Afghanistan, thank you very much. We are also joined by Kim Clark from Erie, Pennsylvania, whose son is stationed there as well. Thanks to all three of you. And now some headlines that we're looking at this morning.
Parts of California are burning. Wildfires in L.A. County are forcing evacuations. And just released economic reporting shows that consumer spending went up a notch. Now, incomes are flat from the previous month. And a suicide bomber tried to kill a Saudi Arabian prince. The prince is active in counter-terror work. He was slightly injured. Those are some of the stories we're following.
In 10 minutes, outgoing New York Times dining critic Frank Bruni on your last meal as a critic and his victory over an eating disorder. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Femi Okay. Now, all of this morning, we have been reporting on a case in California's Bay Area where police have been searching a house where a woman was apparently held prisoner there for 18 years after being abducted as an 11-year-old. The woman is 29-year-old J.C. Dugard. She had two children who were apparently fathered by her captor. He's a convicted sex offender and his wife have also been arrested. Now, following this case is Clint Van Zandt. He's a special agent with the FBI for 25 years. Clint, welcome. You've been following this case and watching it unfold. What's the latest?
Well, of course, the challenges are the comparisons that are being made between here in the States with Elizabeth Smart or in Austria, the case that we know of that took place there. We also had a case here in Missouri in 2007 where one young boy was kidnapped for 4 days, and because of his kidnapping, we were able to find a boy that had been kidnapped 4 years ago that was still held by his captor. So I think the finding of these victims encourages every family who has ever lost a loved one. I think the challenge is right now of how is this family going to be rehabilitated? How are they going to be rolled back into society? Realize that the little girl was 11 years old when she herself was kidnapped, and now she has an 11-year-old daughter and a 15-year-old daughter. None of them have been to school, her not since she was kidnapped, and her two children at all. So that socialization process is going to be enormous.
Clint, long after the public had forgotten this story, the FBI continued to investigate. How does a case like this stay active?
Well, I can tell you as an FBI agent who's worked cases like this, you never give up. You never turn off that emotional front porch light on the house of the victim until you find out for sure that victim is dead. You run the leads, you go over them again, and with the realization that sometimes after a month or a year or 5 years, there's somebody who's willing to talk who at the time of the kidnapping wasn't willing to talk at all. So you have to keep going back and knocking on the same doors, talking to the same people. But in this case, it was just fortuitous. It was the kidnapper and two of the children happened to be passing out some type of leaflets on a college campus, realized that his neighbors describe him as a little crazy. He says he wants to form his own church, hence people describing him as a religious fanatic.
A little crazy, though. Clint, how do you live next door to somebody for 29 years who's holding people prisoner in the backyard?
Well, you know, the challenge becomes, do we really look in our neighbor's backyard today? And I think that's one of, notwithstanding the couple, this 58-year-old man and his 54-year-old wife, they are both responsible. And boy, do I hold that wife responsible, too. She's a woman, and she allowed this all to take place. She's going to say that her husband made her do it. He's going to tell us that the devil made him do it. And the neighbors are going to just shrug their shoulders and said, we never knew. Well, you know, somebody needs to take the time and look over the back fence. And when you see blonde-haired people that are allegedly the biological child of a Hispanic, you know, that's not playing the race card. That's saying, you know, that doesn't look right. Explain to me how this took place. There's a lot of questions that could have been asked over 18 years.
And I'm sure they will be over the next couple of days. A lot of questions still to be asked. But thank you, Clint, for giving us your insight. Clint Van Zandt is an ex-FBI agent. He's been following the case of Jaycee Dugard, who was discovered after 18 years of after being kidnapped.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, The New York Times outgoing food critic Frank Bruni joins us to talk about working and eating when you're a food critic and trying to stay healthy when food is your life. We're also talking about trying not to work when you're on vacation. Are you able to stay completely away in this era of wireless and Blackberries? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. How do you turn off? And right now, let's look at some of the top stories we're following this morning. We've got just released economic reporting that shows consumer spending up a notch. Cash for clunkers sales boosted the spending. Incomes are flat from the previous month. Mourners are now paying respects to Ted Kennedy. He lies in repose at the JFK Presidential Library in Boston. His casket got there from Cape Cod by motorcade, greeted by cheers along the way yesterday. President Obama will be delivering the eulogy at the funeral, which will be held tomorrow.
In the Atlantic, tropical storm Danny is weakening. A storm watch is still on for coastal North Carolina, though. Dangerous waves and riptides are expected in coming days along the East Coast. Overseas, our partner, the BBC, reports that its sources say that U.S. Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke had what is being called an explosive meeting with the Afghan President Hamid Karzai. Holbrooke pressed him on voting fraud allegations. Moving to Iraq now. Two American soldiers are dead there today after an attack in Baghdad. And NASA will attempt to launch the Space Shuttle Discovery late tonight. The launch has been delayed several times because of weather and fuel valve trouble. And those are some of the top stories we're following today. John.
I love that BBC language. Explosive meeting in Kabul. That could have dire consequences, but nobody was injured in that meeting.
That's good.
So at the end of the summer, or the midsummer, at the end of August anyway, the food basket tends to be loaded with the bounty of the growing season. It's really kind of a romantic time for foodies, the summer is. But if your work is food, that can be a killer. Keeping a healthy relationship with food is more than just a question of dieting for a restaurant critic. It can be a matter of life and death. So after years of going undercover as the New York Times restaurant critic, Frank Bruni has written a new book about his own troubled relationship, we learn, with food. Let's just say commitment wasn't the problem with his relationship. The book is called Born Round, The Secret History of a Full-Time Eater. We're joined by Frank Bruni to discuss how he fought his battle with food. Frank, thanks so much for coming in.
Hey, thank you for having
me. I mean, who would have thought Frank Bruni does a diet book? But it's a deep memoir of your relationship with food.
It's a very different kind of diet book. It's really a life narrative, but organized around the principle of eating and food. And my main challenge over the whole course of my life, I realized, was to control my appetite and to find a healthy way to eat. And when I was offered the job of restaurant critic a little over 5 years ago, one of the main questions I had to ask myself and one of the main questions people who knew me well asked me was, are you in a healthy enough place with your food consumption to do this?
But, I mean, anybody looking at the title of this book and knowing your name would assume, oh, gosh, a restaurant critic who's having problems with his weight. Duh, that's an easy one. But, in fact, becoming the restaurant critic was your saving grace.
It was part of the answer.
That's amazing.
Yeah. No, my particular kind of overeating, which I think is pretty classic, was a very binge-purge psychology. And I would allow myself or get drawn into these epic binges because I'd say next week or next month I'm going to be super, super virtuous. And that, of course, was a lie, and I'd break that promise. being in a job where you have to eat a certain amount and a big amount every day meant the only weight maintenance and weight loss mechanisms available to me were portion control and exercise, and those are the best remedies of all.
Are you a cooking foodie or just an eating foodie,
restaurant foodie? I've never been a great cook, but it's been irrelevant over the last 5.5 years because I eat out almost every single night.
I can't say that I feel sorry for you, but it does sound grueling.
So on the front cover of the book, there's this really adorable little boy with cute, chubby cheeks, but you describe some really early, disgusting eating habits that you had. For instance, when you were a baby, you had a huge, huge appetite.
Yes.
And when your mom wouldn't give you stuff, what did you do?
When my mom didn't give me stuff, after a certain point, I would cry so hard I would throw up. And it was obviously...
What age was this?
Well, it started when I was 18 months old, and apparently it went on for about a year. And I joke in the book that I was a baby bulimic. Obviously, I don't think you can be bulimic. But the point was my obsession with food was that intense from a very young age, and it was an obsession that was all about volume and shoveling things in my mouth.
What do you think that comes from?
You know, I think it's mostly probably genes because it was there so early. But in my case, and this is the story I tell in the book, that predisposition played itself out rather disastrously in a large, sprawling Italian-American family where food was everything.
Wow.
Food was love. Food was generosity. Food was wealth. And there was always food at the Bruni house.
Take us to a New Year's Eve at the Bruni house because that was a big splurge so people can understand how much food your family used to eat.
Well, we hosted Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving was our big holiday, and there would be, during the first 90 minutes everybody got there, at least a dozen appetizers being passed around, canapes, what have you. When you got to the table, there had to be, you know, usually two kinds of meat plus a pasta dish. So we're talking three kinds of entrees, you know, innumerable side dishes. And what was most remarkable is the host philosophy was you had to make enough of every one thing that if every guest ate only that thing, it would never run out.
Wow. So I guess you needed a few refrigerators or freezers to deal with the leftovers.
We always had at least one enormous freezer in the garage. And I remember, the meat truck pulling up like every couple months with the meat supply. And we were a meaty family.
So, you know, they say that we are genetically predisposed, you alluded to this a moment ago, to associate food and our relationship with food with the idea of a presumption of scarcity.
Mm-hmm.
That basically we assume scarcity, but that means we binge when there's a lot of food around. In an Italian-American family and going on to be Rome correspondent for the New York Times, that seems to be a prescription for real disaster there.
You know, Rome actually turned out to be a good thing because my Italian-American family was Southern peasant immigrants. So for them, you know, food, a lot of food as a kind of reassurance that you were wealthy and okay in the world was vital. When I went to Rome, I was moving around a different contemporary Italy, and actually what I learned there or was reminded of there was how much more important quality is than quantity. You know, we all puzzle all the time over, you know, why don't French women get fat? Why are Western Europeans slimmer? They're slimmer because they don't have the big gulp. They don't have the all-you-can-eat buffet. They do not eat the portions and the volume that Americans do.
Where did you learn this kind of discipline? I mean, we could almost call your book Resize Me or Downsize Me instead of Supersize Me.
I hit rock bottom when I was 36, 37, I weighed in at about 270 pounds, and I was wearing size...
You? Little you?
And I was wearing size 42 pants, and that was kind of my worst fear come true. It was at the tail end, at that point, of a life of yo-yoing.
I'm guessing you're in 34.
Yeah, exactly.
Wait.
Yeah. When I thought
and this
my...
isn't a diet book, dude?
No, I do think it's funny. I mean, it's an odd kind of diet book. I mean, it's narrative. It's a story.
Yeah. No, but I understand. I don't want to keep going. How much do you weigh now, just so we
I don't know. You know, emails? I don't know. One of the things one of my kind of psychological self-maintenance mechanisms is I don't get on scales. If my clothes fit the way I want them to fit, I walk on because I don't want to get as obsessed about weight as I used to be.
Frank, you're the outgoing food critic of the New York Times. So we're going to squeeze one more food piece of information out of you, which is if you could only eat one dish in your life, one dish left, what would you recommend that we all tried?
Oh, that's too hard because we live in a city with so many wonders, you know.
Right.
I mean, I just had a pasta dish at the new restaurant Marea with octopus and bone marrow, and it sounds crazy, and it was wonderful. The steaks at Minetta Tavern, the best steaks, if you're a steak person and I am, I mean, those are fantastic. So you can't ask someone who has been eating as much great food as I have what one dish he'd go out on.
All right, so if people who love to eat and who like to cook and who like to eat well and go out to restaurants, what's the secret from Frank Bruni to maintaining that discipline to keep you as healthy as you look right now?
Get the things on the menu that you want, but don't eat them to the end of them if you're beginning to get full. So don't make yourself feel deprived, but don't be a pig.
Your grandmother was really special. Would she have loved the book?
I think she would have been so proud. I mean, this book pays very, very loving tribute to my mother and my grandmother, and one of the reasons it was so rewarding to write was because it gave me the opportunity to do that.
You can just imagine that Bruni household. Eat Frankie, eat Frankie. And then he sure did. It's a great twist on the notion of a diet memoir, really a book about one's relationship with food over a very, very interesting life. Thanks for joining us, Frank Bruni, the outgoing restaurant critic for the New York Times, author of the new memoir, Born Round, The Secret History of a Full Time Eater.
I love his takeaway. Don't be a pig.
Yeah, right. Basically, that's it.
So Frank might be taking a bit of a break from food, but President Obama can't take a break from his job, even while he's on vacation. So how about you? Can you completely stay away from work when you're on vacation? And if so, how do you do it?
Surest remedy for me to not do work while I'm on vacation is to stay with my family in Laurinburg, North Carolina, where there is no internet service and a printer that uses dot matrix.
No internet for Patrick Henry Bass. He's our senior editor at Essence Magazine and one of our contributors here on The Takeaway.
Dot matrix printer. Where is he? A museum? NYC radio fan tweets us, in this economy, are you kidding? No matter what paradise I may find myself in, I am chained to my wretched old BlackBerry.
Tell us about your real vacation, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And we are also remembering Ted Kennedy's, as mourners are gathering in Boston to pay their respects.
In the end, he's proof of Hemingway's line that a man can be destroyed without being defeated, just as he can be defeated without being destroyed.
That's Chris Lydon's Takeaway. He's a journalist and political observer in Massachusetts. I'm Femi Okay.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend, everyone. It's The Takeaway.
Foreigners, what do they know about healthcare?
Yeah, really.
$22,750. In England, government health officials decided that's how much 6 months of life is worth. Under their socialized system, if a medical treatment costs more, you're out of luck. That's wrong for America.
Sorting out the horror from the hype as we ask Americans overseas about their healthcare. This message has been approved by The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It is Friday, August the 28th. I am Femi Okay here with John Hockenberry. Good morning, John.
All them foreigners. What's that about? Good morning, Femi. Coming up this hour, some troubling news from the FDIC. They're getting low balance notices over there. And we're going to call it the world's biggest yard sale. California kicks off a sale of odds and ends, hoping to plug holes in its budget.
But first, let's go to Christine Geyer. She moved to Germany back in 2002. Now, Christina, you're actually missing out on all of our screaming town hall meetings, our passionate debates. But what do Germans make of U.S. healthcare?
I think Germans don't really understand why Americans don't want to have universal health care. The system here works pretty well. I mean, Germans, of course, have some issues with it, but it works so much better than the system in the United States.
Ah, interesting. So we will be back with you in just a moment to find out if Germany is actually offering better health care than the U.S. and also be visiting some other European countries to do a compare and contrast. But first, everything you need to know this morning.
Their healthcare runs on time. We'll find out about that later. In the headlines, people mourning Senator Ted Kennedy are now paying respects at the JFK Presidential Library in Boston. Tens of thousands have seen his casket there so far. Esther Colby was one of them.
I'm a Republican, but that's all beside the board. When something happens to a family or a neighbor, all those things don't make any difference. I wish them all well. God bless them.
Tomorrow, President Obama will speak at Kennedy's funeral mass. A new economic report shows consumer spending is up a notch, and cash for clunkers sales was the reason for the boosted spending. Incomes are flat, though, from the previous month.
On the West Coast, hundreds of firefighters are working to put out wildfires in Los Angeles County. Flames are threatening a number of communities there, forcing evacuations. And moving to the east, where a tropical storm watch is on for coastal North Carolina, Tropical Storm Danny is weaker this morning, but still expected to produce dangerous waves along the east coast.
Futures trading suggests Wall Street will be happy when it opens in about a half hour. It was up just a touch yesterday. The Dow opens today at 95.81. The S&P begins at 10.31. And the NASDAQ begins at 20.28. President Obama is supposed to be resting on Martha's Vineyard. Not much of a vacation, eh? But how does anyone have a vacation these days when we're all completely connected wirelessly and Blackberries? You know the drill.
Marcy Elbaher calling from New York. So most of the time, my work and life are completely intertwined. But it's important to me to have a few weeks a year when I unplug. I returned refreshed, filled with ideas. The only problem is that the few weeks pre-unplugging are pure hell.
Pre-unplugging anxiety. Tell us your stories of how you unplug and have a real vacation in this bizarre, electronically connected 21st century. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
So, John, some people could say that U.S. healthcare benefits and comparing them with healthcare overseas is a bit like comparing apples and oranges.
Well, you hear that a lot, actually. Canada has nothing to do with us. Germany, forget about it.
So today, as we wrap up our week-long series of healthcare roundtables, we wanted to talk to Americans living abroad to see how their healthcare is different.
That's a good idea.
So joining us, we have Christina Geyer. She's in Bavaria, Germany, where she's lived since 2002. Morning to you again, Christina.
Good morning.
Hello to Lynn Udalouf. She's on the line from Moscow, and you've been there for 10 years, Lynn, right?
Oh, 11 now, I guess. Yes, good morning.
Good morning to you. And hello, finally, to Amanda Graham. You're joining us from County Derry, Northern Ireland. And Northern Ireland, I have to remind our audience, is part of the United Kingdom. So you're really looking at socialized medicine, aren't you, Amanda?
Yes, good morning. That's correct.
Hello to you all. So I moved overseas a number of times, and I know that, like me, you must have been worried about healthcare. What was it like getting to grips with healthcare in your new country? So, Lynn, 11 years in Moscow, think back 11 years. What was that first couple of months like, trying to work out where your healthcare was coming from?
Well, I would say I wasn't prepared for my first excursions to clinics because I didn't have young family. But as the years passed, I realized how important it was to have good quality care for my children. And, of course, myself, as I had prenatal work done. And it was really then, probably within a year or two of my moving here, that I understood how different the two systems are.
Amanda Graham, you're in County Derry in Northern Ireland. Now, the UK health system has been slammed here in the United States. So what was your first experience of it like?
Well, it was a little bit of a culture shock at first. It was quite an easy transition. The first appointment that we made was for a new patient appointment. And the only reason why we had to wait about a week is because we decided to book all of the family together. So, I mean, I can't really complain. It was just like going to a family practice at home. We were seen on time. The doctor was very personable. The care was adequate. We were given prescriptions and referrals to specialists that were made within a month's time because they were non-urgent issues.
Christina Geyer, you're in Bavaria, Germany. Welcome back to the conversation. When you first went to Germany, what was your first impression of healthcare?
Well, my first experience with healthcare was looking at my paycheck and seeing that 7% of my pay and 7% of the employer's contribution had gone to healthcare. And that was pretty shocking. But as I went through the system and the other person said, when I got a family, I realized that it's worth it to have all this health care and that paying for everybody makes society better.
So you're being taxed for everybody else's health care. What do you get for that?
I don't pay anything. I can go to the doctor. I don't have a wait. I usually get in. I call in the morning before I want to go, and they say come in an hour or two.
No copay?
No copay. If you have public, I have private insurance here in Germany. If you have public insurance, you pay a 10 euro copay once every 3 months.
So it's basically free?
Yes.
So wait a minute. Private is free and public is a copay?
But I pay my insurance premiums.
I see. Interesting. So that's the German experience. Christina Geyer, right?
Yes.
Yep.
Public insurance, you pay about 14% with half of the employer and employee contribution, and with private insurance, the insurance company sets a premium for you.
Lynn Udalov is on our line from Moscow. Lynn, for all of the time that you've been out there in Moscow, and you've had enough time to work out, what's the biggest difference between Russian healthcare and American healthcare?
Okay. Well, I guess I'm in a fortunate position. I don't just think of how my little family is cared for, but I also observe the many families of a large corporation here as an expat coordinator. And so I'm often engaged in taking them through a clinic, taking them through what might be an evacuation, putting them on a plane to be repatriated, to go home for surgery, or simply evacuated as quickly as possible to some place that can care for them. I would say that there's two real different levels when you're living in Moscow. If you've come as a student or as a sort of a fellow or something, that you have very little pay, you're probably not going to be given a package with health insurance that would get you into a lovely expatriate clinic. It would probably give you enough money to, with the help of your Russian colleagues, to get to a local clinic and set a leg or something of the like. And then you'd have to be pretty resourceful to get yourself out of the country if necessary.
So there's a two-tier system. There's a two-tier system there in Moscow.
Well, if you have money, if you've come with a large company and you have a nice package that would include a good salary and schooling and health insurance, global health insurance, then you'd be cared for quite well. But you shouldn't confuse a posh clinic that serves you in your language and serves you with pharmaceuticals that you're familiar to a hospital, because oftentimes people think, oh, well, they have a nice desk, they have a nice sort of bedside manner in the small holding area if you're there for a day for observation. But ultimately, they would have to put you into a Russian hospital with more diagnostics and maybe surgical operations. Or you have to make plans quickly to get yourself out of the country.
Amanda Graham, you're in Northern Ireland. Now, at the top of the program, we played one of the ads that have been going around the country in here in the United States, talking about the horrors of the UK health system, that there are death panels that decide whether you can get treatment or not, that the lines that you have to go into are going to be so long that you actually die before you actually get to see your doctor. What can you tell us realistically from experiencing UK healthcare that maybe Americans can learn from?
I'm going to have to say that I think there's just it's a giant misconception that's going around in America right now. When I take a look at the news back at home, I see where they're arguing about government rationed health care and that senior citizens are treated as if their life may not be valued as much in the medical community, which is simply not true. They also have organizations, I think it's called Concern for the Aged, that are also proactive, since this country is very big on human rights. So I haven't seen personally where those claims could possibly be true. My father-in-law is an older man with considerable health issues that it's necessary for his care, so I don't see where any of that's been true. He's been taken care of very adequately for his needs, and more than what we get at home.
Amanda Graham, let me ask you a personal question. Lynn Udalov in Moscow just mentioned that part of her insurance for health care in Russia is a plane out of there if things get really rough. I mean, in principle anyway. Would you consider leaving if things got dire enough with your family, Amanda Graham, there in Northern Ireland?
As far as you mean, for medical needs, if
right,
things got
dire. Right, exactly.
If it ever came to that, it's But I can't imagine it would, because part of also addressing that, where they're saying there's such long waits where people die waiting for the NHS. I also see here where if there is a long wait within the NHS trust hospitals, they do send you to private sector, and they will also pay for your expenses to travel. Like if I had to leave Ireland to see a specialist in England, they would pay to send me there.
Interesting.
Christine, sorry, Amanda, carry on.
I was just saying, they do work around with their waits, because certain areas with different populations are going to have longer wait times. But if you have an urgent need that definitely needs addressed, a serious condition, they're going to make sure that it's taken care of.
I'm just going to get a few words from all of you as we go around our round table really quickly. It's a quick fire round. Christina Geyer in Bavaria, Germany. Which system do you prefer, US or Germany's?
Oh, Germany by far.
Wow.
Lynn Udalov.
One for Germany, okay.
Line on the line from Moscow. Moscow or back home here in the United States?
Oh, by far back home in the United States. Delivering a baby in the U.S. is a far more preferred fashion for myself. My husband described the facilities in Middle America as Star Wars as compared to what they would offer me here. So he would agree as well that we would go home.
And very quickly, Amanda Graham, I think I know the answer. Do you miss healthcare back at home or not?
You know, considering I also worked with it for a while, I think this system here is far better, because you don't have the stress about where the money's coming from and being tied down to a job that is because you have the healthcare through there.
So that is two votes for the foreign healthcare systems and one vote for us back here in the United States. Amanda Graham in Northern Ireland, Lynn Udalov from Moscow, and Christina Geyer in Bavaria, Germany. Thanks to you all for being on our round table this morning. And you can learn more about the healthcare systems in the countries we've been talking about by visiting thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here with Femi Okay. Are you someone that balances your checkbook regularly? Like, do you know your
balance
all the time?
Yeah, I have to. I work in public radio.
No, good for you. Because I always, at the ATM, when I check balance, I always do a gulp as I wait for the number to come up.
Surprise!
Kind of a mystery number. Maybe you have the same sort of experience. But on a macro scale, that's why we invited the Louise Story, Wall Street and finance reporter for the New York Times, into the studio this morning. Good morning, Louise.
Hi.
If the FDIC went to its ATM and checked its balance this morning, they might have a really big gulp that would be pretty meaningful for the rest of us. The FDIC, of course, is the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. What's going on, Louise?
Well, what's going on is we've got more and more troubled banks that they're having to shut down. And when they shut down a bank, they often have to use money from their funding to pay for the process. And this FDIC fund is like an insurance fund. All the other banks put in money to have this piggy bank for troubled times. Right now, it's a pretty troubled time, and we're using it up.
You know, the inklings of this were on the front page of the business section last Friday at your newspaper, but
yep.
A lot of the details are coming out. For instance, the number of troubled banks, it was hovering around 200, but it seems to be even rising.
Yeah, now we're up to 416 troubled banks. A lot of those will be shut down, and it's very smooth. The FDIC goes in on a Friday, and they shut it down, they bring in a buyer, and by Monday they typically have the bank opened up. So they try to make it so that people aren't panicking. That doesn't always work, of course. If you remember, IndyMac was just a year ago.
Sure.
And people were very panicked around IndyMac.
And in the course of that shutdown and reopening, a lot of very big checks are written by the FDIC, and that's what the drawdown is all about.
Exactly.
Now, what are they doing to deal with this besides asking the Federal Reserve for more money?
So what they do actually is they ask banks to pay more money, and they're raising the fees in the banks. And this
premiums.
Affects
that's
premiums.
Insurance premiums.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that affects all of us, because actually several banks now, including J.P. Morgan and Wells Fargo, are starting to pass these FDIC premiums on down to customers. On some of your bank statements, you can look and see FDIC charge. So we're all paying for it. And if they run out of money in that fund, they can use an $100 billion credit line they've got from the Treasury.
And the last sort of line of defense is getting other banks to buy the troubled banks so the FDIC doesn't have to go in. They're trying to make that easier, right?
Yeah, they've had all these rules that they've changed to make it easier for private equity to buy banks and to make it easier for other banks to buy banks. And the other aspect of this to think about is that we're going into a big debate in the fall about what agencies will have more power, and the powers of the FDIC as well as the SEC and everyone in Washington is under debate. So anytime you're seeing these numbers come out about the FDIC, you got to think, are they worried about their power? Are they worried about their influence in Washington?
The big ripple effect of the FDIC will be our takeaway this morning. Louise Story, thanks for being with us. Wall Street and finance reporter for The New York Times.
Oh, John, this takes me back.
Ships.
Yeah.
Eric Estrada.
And his big motorbike. Do you know, you could actually buy a bike like that today.
Really? Why?
California is on sale.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they're having a garage sale.
They're selling the Chips bikes.
Well, something similar to that. Some of the state motorcyclist bikes, they're going to be on sale. A whole load of stuff is actually going to be on sale starting today.
To raise money to cover their deficit?
Literally, yes. You know, like you and I might actually have a bit of a garage sale to raise some cash. That California is on sale today.
I heard it's like $26 billion. How are a couple of motorcycles going to help that? I mean, they should sell something big, like maybe Yosemite or like the Redwoods.
So, we're not just the only people making fun of this. Have a listen to Jimmy Kimmel Live. He was poking fun at California's garage sale.
It's Arnold's California Gold Rush garage sale, and everything must go. Staplers, hasta la vista, baby. Post-it notes, they won't be back. I've got hammers, Humvees, hammers, hamsters, even hammers. It's not a tumor. It's a garage sale. Everything must go.
Even Louise is laughing. She was talking earlier about the FDIC. So the big sale, Louise, and everybody, starts today at a warehouse in Sacramento. Eric Lamaro will be there. He's bright and early. He's actually en route right now. He's the spokesman for the California Department of General Services. We are teasing you a little bit, Eric.
Oh, a little. Gosh, yeah, I hope he doesn't hang up on us.
What's the whole point of this?
Hey, thanks. Good morning, guys. I love hearing that Chips music. Love that show as a kid. Yeah, you know, we're trying to generate some revenue for California. The governor made it clear he wants us to clean out our state closets, get rid of waste, get rid of items that aren't needed anymore, and sell them off to the public at some great deals. So that's what we're going to be doing today and all day today and about half day tomorrow.
Give us a quick preview. What's some of the best stuff that you know that's going to be up for auction?
Well, we do have five of those Chips bikes. We've got five BMW motorcycles from our California Highway Patrol, about 100 more police cars, and about 6,000 other cars in total that'll be available to the public, most of them on auction. About 15 of them were signed recently by the governor. The visors in the car were signed, and we sold those on eBay. And we've got about 6,000 other surplus property items, everything from surfboards to bikes to pianos to...
Why does the state own surfboards?
Why do we own surfboards?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of those come from our law enforcement agencies through confiscation or perhaps stolen property that was never recovered. But a great deal of the items, we've got thousands of computers, copiers, faxes, cameras, you name it, we've got it.
So I'm looking at the online brochure for California's big garage sale. How is it actually going to be run? Do I have to be there to bid, or how do I do it?
You know, you do. Unfortunately, everybody else across the nation had a chance at some items we had on Craigslist and eBay over the last week. But today, you've got to get to Sacramento, and we expect thousands of people at our door when we open up around 8 a.m. this morning.
So, to be serious for a moment, California really is in a lot of trouble as far as their budget is concerned. How much money do you think you might make?
Well, it is a tough time across the nation. Our governor recently worked with our legislature to close our budget gap. But, yeah, we still have a problem in California and across the country. We estimate we'll generate probably about $1 million in revenue. But the more important thing is that we're clearing out items that we don't need anymore. We're cutting waste and we're giving good deals to the public.
Eric, you're there a bit early. Are you looking for some good stuff for yourself, maybe?
You know, unfortunately, I'm working this, helping you guys get the word out, and I'm not going to be able to buy anything, but maybe I can find my Aunt Sally or someone to come in and buy something for me.
But I guess the question is this symbolic, or is this, you know, in a sense that it shows the state is willing to sacrifice, or is this going to be real revenue for you?
Well, I think what it shows is that we're committed to getting rid of items we don't need anymore. It's high time that we stopped storing items for years and years that we don't need, and items that taxpayers paid for, we need to get those items back to taxpayers. The vehicles are also part of the governor's effort to cut our fleet. We've got too many state vehicles in our fleet, and he wants to see that cut by 15%, and we're seeing a lot of those vehicles coming through. So that's really what this is about, is eliminating waste, cleaning out our closets, and letting the taxpayers take advantage of what they paid for in the first place.
Eric, I know you have a garage sale to get to, so I'll let you go. Eric Lamoureux, he's the spokesman for the California Department of General Services. Thanks, Eric.
Kind of a cash for clunkers program there in California. Let's look at some of the stories we're following this morning. Just released economic reporting shows consumer spending up a notch. Cash for clunker sales boosted spending there. Incomes are flat from the previous month. Tropical Storm Danny is weaker, but it's headed for North Carolina's coast. And wildfires are raging in California. Coming up, mourners in Boston remembering Ted Kennedy.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I think that now is the time to reflect on and honor the life and accomplishments of Ted Kennedy and to pray for the comfort of Vicky Kennedy and the whole family.
That was Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick speaking Wednesday at a press conference where he declared this a time of mourning and reflection. But the governor's office is feeling pressure from Capitol Hill to sign into law a bill which the late senator himself proposed. Now, if it's actually passed, the bill would give Governor Patrick the legal authority to name a temporary replacement for the senator. But the current law mandates that Patrick wait at least 145 days to hold a special election. Joining us now is a man that's really involved in the current legal proceedings. Timothy Murray is the Lieutenant Governor for the state of Massachusetts. Good morning to you, Timothy Murray.
How are you? Good morning.
Now, the question is, do you honor a dying man's political wish or do you uphold the longstanding law of the land? Where do you stand on that?
Well, you know, the debate, I think, will begin in earnest next week. But I think right now, appropriately so, as the governor mentioned, that, you know, we need to celebrate Ted Kennedy's legacy, his life, and be there to support his family. And clearly, he made a request. It's one that, that deserves, I think, serious and prompt consideration and one that that I support. But after this weekend, there'll be, I think, a real vigorous debate and discussion on that and hopefully a quick resolution.
If you don't mind us preempting the weekend break and just getting straight to that discussion, why do you think Senator Ted Kennedy asked Governor Patrick to make an exceptional concession?
Well, I think he understood, perhaps better than anyone, as someone who served for 40-plus years, about how each and every vote matters and how having all people on deck to represent Massachusetts. Certainly the health care debate is taking place as we speak, and that is often talked about as the why that the vote is so important. But we also have the Federal Transportation Reauthorization Bill that is likely to come up in the fall or some version of it. That's billions and billions of dollars, and a change in a formula or tweak of a formula one way or another could have a very negative and adverse impacts on the Commonwealth's efforts and states in the Northeast to try to address our rail, road, and bridge infrastructure. So there's a lot of moving parts and a lot of legislation, and it is, I think, in the Commonwealth's best interest to have a full delegation working day in and day out to protect the interests of Massachusetts and look for opportunities to help grow the economy and create jobs.
Lieutenant Governor, let me just play you a little bit of sound from Governor Patrick from Wednesday, where he really does understand the urgency of succession in the Massachusetts Senate seat.
I think it's a particularly timely request at a time when there are such profoundly important proposals pending in the Congress. Massachusetts needs two voices in the United States Senate.
And when I looked at the history of what was happening in Massachusetts and went back to the idea of succession in Massachusetts, it did seem really hypocritical, considering that Mitt Romney was barred from naming a replacement for John Kerry's seat had he won the presidency in 2004. But now the Democrats want to change the law back so that they can put a Democrat in that Senate seat. How do you respond to that kind of accusation? Is there grounds for the hypocrisy idea?
Well, you know, the governor and I were not at the State House. There are and I think a fairly significant number of state reps and state senators that did not participate or take place in that vote in 2004. And so is every legislature or every governor bound by votes that were taken 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years ago? I don't think so. But certainly, you know, politics and party politics play a role in all of this, and that's what happens when people and parties are in power. They make decisions that they think are in the interest of the people that sent them and their philosophical approach to things. So I don't think that's a surprise that politics is a factor. I don't think it is the driving factor, but it is a factor here.
Lieutenant Governor, thank you for joining us this morning. Timothy Murray, Lieutenant Governor for the state of Massachusetts.
What I wrote, I said, you know, today an angel has earned his wings, and we'll all miss him and for what he did, and hopefully there'll be somebody else who can not replace him but have the same effect as he did.
That's 25-year-old Boston resident Kadar Frederick giving us his remembrance of Senator Ted Kennedy at the JFK Presidential Library in Boston. And Arnold Howe, you're a bit older than 25, I gather, huh?
Hello?
You're a little older than 25, right, Arnold?
Yes, I am.
And there's about a half mile between you and the front door of the JFK Museum, right?
That's correct. And the crowd is about four to five abreast. Yes.
So standing.
I'm 76. I'm a year younger than Senator Kennedy.
So he was a year ahead of you, and your pilgrimage to the museum is really the continuation of a very personal relationship you've had with the senator since you were in college, right?
Yes. He lived in Winthrop House. I lived in Kirkland House. They were diagonally opposite one another, and we used the same pathway to get down to the practice field afternoons. I went to track practice along with my twin, Alan, and Teddy Kennedy was on his way to football practice, and I was 10 steps behind him every practice day for about 2 years. But I'm here because I decided to come full circle. In 1963, my twin and I and another friend decided the night before President Kennedy's funeral that we would take my brother's car. It happened to be a 1958 Cadillac limousine that he had purchased. It was 5 years old. And we drove down to Washington, D.C., parked somewhere in Washington, and joined the crowd not very far from the church and saw all of the processions, you know, the procession into the church, you know, the parade procession out. We followed it after the ceremony along the street. So, of course, there weren't telethons those days. But we couldn't get to Arlington National Park at that time. But late in the day, around 6 o'clock, we were able to go to Arlington National Cemetery and see the gravesite.
Wow, that's quite it's quite a story.
And then
what do
we drove home.
Arnold,
so I decided I had to come full circle because Ted Kennedy is, you know, in terms of age, essentially my peer. I'm his peer in terms of age.
Well, both at Harvard together, and that's quite a story of being there in 1963 at the funeral of JFK, a half a mile from the front of the JFK Museum. Good luck to you, Arnold.
Yes, thank you.
76-year-old Arnold Howe, one of the people, and he's towards the end of the line at this point, paying their respects to Senator Ted Kennedy up in Boston. And now for a look at the headlines.
Thanks, John. Another U.S. service member is dead in Afghanistan. That means that August is now the deadliest month for American troops there since the war began. Moving to the political situation in Afghanistan, our partner, the BBC, reports that its sources are saying that the U.S. Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke had what's been called an explosive meeting with Afghan President Hamid Karzai, and the outbreak was over Holbrooke's raising concerns about voting fraud in Afghanistan. Now, you were just talking to Arnold Howe. He was a twin. We're going to have twins coming up in just a moment. Twin tennis players. You won't want to miss them in 10 minutes' time.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Femi Okay.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
Good morning. It's Friday, the day we check out new movies on the show. Pass the popcorn, please. Arefa Guzman.
Can we have breakfast first?
I had popcorn for breakfast, but that's tragic. Film critic for Newsday is here to talk about Ang Lee's Taking Woodstock and the September issue. Good morning, Rafa.
Morning.
Let's start with Ang Lee's Taking Woodstock. It's out this weekend. Why so late? It's actually behind the anniversary of the actual Woodstock concert.
That's a good point. I don't know why it's out so late, but it has been pushed back a little here and there. I think the date has changed, and I don't know why they decided to release it on a Wednesday either. Maybe to get a jump on the on the weekend. There's not much else out that's coming out this weekend in terms of mainstream releases, aside from a couple of horror films. So maybe they thought they'd get a jump on the weekend.
You sort of think this is kind of a horror film in your review.
Well, I don't know if I thought it was quite that bad, but I just didn't think it was quite as successful as it could have been, especially coming from a filmmaker like Ang Lee.
Give us a quick plot summary.
It's kind of two stories in one. It's based on the memoir of Elliot Tiber, who was a young man at the time running a very dumpy Catskills motel with his parents when the Woodstock organizers came to town, and they wound up using his motel as home base for their operations. The other story is that Tiber was sort of a semi-closeted gay man at the time. He was out when he lived in New York City, but he was, you know, much more in the closet when living with his parents in the Catskills.
If you only could see one movie this week, would Taking Woodstock be one of them?
If you're a horror fan, there are probably better ones. Halloween 2 and Final Destination are coming out. But, I think the September issue is a much livelier, a much more enjoyable film.
Well, this is a documentary, right?
That's a documentary on Anna Wintour and the making of the September 2000 issue of Vogue, the famously fat September issue.
Let's listen to a quick clip.
Fashion's not about looking back. It's always about looking forward.
Yeah, we really feel that this is the most important message to put in a September issue.
I thought it was pretty.
You can hear her staff are terrified of her. This is funny. I've saw the trailer.
Yes.
And I keep laughing every time I see it. It's hilarious.
It's R.J. Cutler, my old buddy.
Is that right?
I have to recuse myself on this one since we're pals.
From Great Neck.
Yeah. Well, from The War Room, and he actually was executive producer of a radio show I did a long time ago.
We worked together for years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he does a good job in this film, I think. He definitely does a good job of humanizing Anna Wintour, which, you know, not easy to do. I mean,
if you
believe her public persona, but she does come across as much more likable and much more personable in this film than you'd imagine.
And the plot line does what? It follows the September issue, which is a big deal in Vogue. September is January in the fashion world, one of the characters actually says in the documentary.
Right, exactly. And, it basically follows all the sort of nitty-gritties of the photo shoots, redoing the photo shoots, traveling to, you know, Paris, London, Rome.
And that this can be successful after The Devil Wore Prada is a real testimony.
Yes, that's true. It's true. Well, it's a testimony to the increasing, the continuing fascination I think people have right. with Anna Wintour.
Rafer Guzman, he's the film critic for Newsday. He's been talking to us about Ang Lee's Taken Woodstock and the September issue. Thanks, Rafer.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, I'm a dad of two sets of twins. It's twin mania around here.
So we've got many children in your family.
Identical twins here in the studio. Bob and Mike Bryan, top-rated professional doubles team in the universe.
I'm excited.
We'll speak with them in just a few moments. Right now, let's have a look at some of the top stories we're following this morning, including another U.S. service member dead in Afghanistan. That means August is now the deadliest month for American troops there since the war began. Ted Kennedy now lies in repose at the Kennedy Presidential Library in Boston. Tens of thousands have already filed past his casket. Tomorrow, President Obama delivers a eulogy at the funeral.
Consumer spending went up just a little bit last month. It was due largely to sales from cash for clunkers rebates. Incomes are flat from the previous month. Consumer sentiment numbers will be out in just a couple of minutes. Meanwhile, in Detroit, nearly 3 in 10 people are out of a job. The unemployment rate there is 28.9%. That's the highest since record keeping began in 1970. That's a look at some stories we're following this morning.
So Femi, I had this completely freaky dream last night. About I was in the U.S. Open tennis tournament. Okay,
yes.
It's beginning here in New York. I was standing on the court. I was ready to play in the quarterfinals. And then I was suddenly terrified. From The Shining, those two freaky twin girls.
You're
as they
scaring
come
me.
And
Stop
play
it.
With us, Danny. And then all of a sudden, in my dream, out of the blue, poof.
What?
The scene dissolves into this goofy California commercial.
What were you drinking before you went to bed?
Yeah, well,
the story, isn't it? But I see that my dream has actually come true this morning in the form of two very scary tennis twins from California. The Bryan brothers are here in the studio. Bob and Mike, good morning.
How you doing?
Good morning.
So Mike, what was your record against Rafael Nadal?
That's Bob over there. Mike, I'm 3-0 versus Rafael Nadal.
Identical twins, 3-0.
Yes.
And your record against Roger Federer, Bob?
4-3.
All right, so you're Mike, you're Bob.
Wrong.
No, the other way around.
All right.
Bob's
identical
green.
Identical twins in the studio. Yeah. And the interesting point here is that you've beaten Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer at doubles.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty proud of, we're pretty proud of our record against those guys. They're obviously, you know, we're big fans of them. We watch them on TV all the time, but when we get them on the doubles court, yeah, we got the advantage.
Now, did you know he was going to talk there? Do you have like a special
we have ESP,
communication?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, that's what they say about you. That in fact, there are qualities of your play on the professional doubles tennis circuit that give you a professional advantage. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, it's true. Doubles is all about communication, and we've played 10,000 matches together since we were 2 years old. You know, and we moved together on the court. It's all about filling the holes. And, you know, I know what to expect out of him. You know, we basically read each other's minds. We don't use signals out there. And, yeah, I mean, that's why we have a huge advantage over most teams.
I mean, some people predict that over the next 2 years you will become the winningest numerically in terms of professional titles that you've won of any doubles team in history, correct?
Yeah, who knows? I mean, if we
62?
Stay healthy, if we win 62, yeah, we'll have the record. Right now we have 54. And, yeah, we're on pace, and we both feel pretty good. We're 31 years old. Hope to do this for another 5 or 6 years, and, yeah, we're still having fun doing it.
And you've been pros since before college. You dropped out of college to be pro.
Yeah, we went 2 years to Stanford, and then we dropped out, yeah. College
yeah,
dropouts, and 98 we left, and we've been doing it ever since.
Now, somebody has described you in the profile of you in the New Yorker that's on the stands this week as the closest thing to a genetically engineered doubles team that's ever likely to happen in existence. Now, is that an insult?
Yeah. No, I mean, we're pretty lucky we're righty-lefty. We're mirror image twins.
Well, explain how that works on the court.
It really helps in doubles because none of us have to serve in the sun. You have different spins coming at you. Yeah, and we have our forehands on the outside, which, you know, it's huge. It doesn't hurt being 6'3". And so
yeah,
we get up for
hurt.
Lobs. We cover the court pretty well.
You're both 6'3"?
I'm 6'4".
he's got me by a little bit.
A little tension here. A little tension here.
You can feel it.
Yeah. What's your mission for this year's U.S. Open? Because in the New Yorker profile, they describe a match that you really blew.
Yeah. Which one was that? We've blown a lot of matches in our day. But, yeah, there's a team that you know, is nipping at our heels right now. We're going to be seeded number one at the Open, but, you know, the number two team just beat us last week, Nestor and Zimonjic, and, yeah, that's our big rival right now. So we're hoping to get to the finals and play those guys again.
Mike, there's something very compelling about your story. You can tell Johnny's just riffing off the whole twins thing. You're tall, you're attractive, you've been playing tennis for a long time. Why don't more
tall,
people
attractive.
Know about you?
I mean, I think we pick doubles. We love playing together. But singles is what catches everyone's eye. It's on TV. The singles players are stars because they're playing hours and hours on TV. We're making a name for ourselves in doubles. Fans love to watch us. But it's mainly the exposure.
Well, Femi raises a great point. I mean, in some sense, people say you are the reason doubles professional tennis even exists anymore. You are the reason that I mean, some people say you're trying to save doubles tennis. First of all, what's wrong with doubles tennis, and how can two guys save it?
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with doubles tennis. You know, 90% of the public plays doubles and has fun playing doubles. It's just, like Mike said, it's the TV exposure. Doubles doesn't get it. People, you know, come, they want to see stars. They don't care if Andy Roddick's brushing his teeth. They want to see the guy because he's on TV.
I don't want to see Andy Roddick brushing his teeth.
Yeah, I mean...
Have you seen Andy Roddick brushing his teeth?
I have.
You have?
<I'm pretty laughs>
right. Look at that.
But
is doubles the better game?
I think so.
Because?
I think it's more exciting. It's faster. There's a lot of shots. Singles is kind of, you know, it's back and forth. It's kind of like ping pong. But doubles, you got the communication.
Anymore.
You got guys getting hit by balls. You got angles. You got everything.
Bob, what about the pay? Do you get paid as much when you win a game playing doubles as when you play singles?
Unfortunately not, but it's not a bad check. You know, if you win the U.S. Open, it's $440,000. which, yeah, I mean, we could use that to do a lot of stuff.
And we share our money, so we put it together.
Yeah, but that's the other story here. And as a dad of two sets of twins, I mean, your parents raised you to be exactly equal. I'm actually a little shocked that you're not dressed identically here in the studio.
Yeah, we try to downplay the whole twin thing. We've been doing it our whole life, and we dress the same on the court. But yeah,
if you won, then he had to win the next time, right?
Exactly. We flipped a coin for the matches when we were young. We shared the trophies, and we didn't become competitors. So that's probably why we're doing it right now.
Is that a little freaky, though?
Yeah,
should I do that with my kids?
You have two sets?
Two sets, yeah.
That's crazy.
yeah, you should.
Yeah, if one twin starts beating up on the other twin, one can lose confidence and stop playing the game. So
if...
Don't have them play against each other when they're young.
Don't have them play against each other when they're young.
Have them be a team.
Yeah. So you never fight?
Every day, but... yeah. It's... When you're twins, you forget the fights 5 minutes later. But we definitely have fist fights.
So you definitely have fist fights. All right. So you mentioned before that one of you is a righty. Which one's a righty?
Mike.
And who's the...
Bob's the lefty.
Right. Okay. So normally that means that you play on the outside so that your forehands have a wider reach, right? But
yeah,
you do it just the opposite.
We do the opposite. I'm the lefty. I play the deuce court. We like the forehand volleys in the middle just for more reach. We feel like, you know, poaching's our game, and we like more reach on the volley.
It's not a conventional way to play. Most of the great teams like the Woodies, you know, the best team of all time, they play the opposite way. McEnroe Fleming. But just
they're
for us, it works out.
What about the Jensen brothers?
Jensen brothers are our heroes, man. They're great guys. They won the French Open in 93. You know,
they were supposed to save doubles tennis.
They did. You know, they put doubles on the map and you know, in the 90s, and they saved it.
They're crazy. They're fun for the fans.
And one of the Jensens is at Syracuse coaching now. Yeah, what's your follow-up act to tennis?
That's tough. Probably music.
Yeah? You know, we got an album coming out?
We got an album coming out on Tuesday. You know, our buddy David Barron, we're a three-piece band, and he's kind of taking our music to the next level.
What kind of music?
It's pop rock. You know, we're going to play at Arthur Ashe Kids Day tomorrow. And
Let's hear some.
I left home at 17. I left home, I left everything. The sky was high and the stars were bright. I met you on a lonely night. I held your hand.
Did you have a bet of how soon during the interview I would play that tune?
Goodness. I can hear the girls screaming now in the background. I can't tell which one's which, though, for the duet, can you?
I don't know. I mean, they start out trying to be the best doubles team in the world, and then you go straight off to compete against the Jonas Brothers?
I don't know if you guys are nuts with them. We're doing this as a fun project. You know, we've always been playing music. We didn't have TV in our house, so we had the instruments, and we were always banging on them at a young age, and... yeah, just making songs in our hotel room our whole life. And we met our boy David Barron, and, you know, he's the vocalist, and he's made this a reality.
The hard, tough life of the Bryan brothers. Good luck with the album. Good luck at the U.S. Open. Bob and Mike Bryan playing in the U.S. Open, soon to be perhaps the winningest professional doubles team of all time.
If you're curious to see what Bob and Mike look like, go to thetakeaway.org. We did a little We did a little video. It was very funny. The Bryan brothers and Femi and John all together.
We put the ESP thing to rest.
Yeah, embarrassing each other. So you can catch up on anything you've missed at thetakeaway.org. Our roundtable health debates are there. All of the information about the health debate that we've been turning over all this week, all there.
I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend.
And I'm Femi O'Kay. Have an excellent weekend. It's been fun being with you, John. Thanks.
Oh, it's always fun with you, Femi. You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.